From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, covering the civil war in Zaire, we talked to Howard French of the New York Times, who is in Kinshasa, the capital of Zaire. The longtime dictator of the country, Mobutu Sese Seko, is under pressure from the international community to give up power, and he's facing rebel troops which are approaching the capital. The troops, led by Mobutu's longtime rival, Laurent Kabila, have already taken over most of the country. The people of Kinshasa are waiting nervously to see what will happen next. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Down by the River, a new novel by the Irish writer Edna O'Brien. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The nominee for CIA director is speaking to senators on Capitol Hill. George Tenet has already won warm praise from several senators, including Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Richard Shelby. Shelby says he expects the full Senate will confirm Tenet this week. Tenet has laid out his vision for the job, saying it will be honest intelligence work.
To the President and all others who rely on our nation's intelligence capabilities, I will deliver intelligence that is clear and objective and does not pull punches. To the Congress, you can expect forthright and candid views about our mission, programs, and priorities. I will not hold back. To the men and women I hope to lead over the next 4 years, we will be partners. I know that you do not bring just your expertise to work every morning. You bring your dedication and your deep conviction that national security is neither a 9-to-5 job nor a career, but a public service.
Tenet has been acting CIA director for the past 6 months. The previous nominee, Anthony Lake, withdrew his nomination under heavy criticism earlier this year. Texas authorities are still looking for one member of the secessionist group, the Republic of Texas. A second fugitive was shot and killed yesterday after trading gunfire with police. He hasn't been formally identified, but he's believed to be Mike Mattson, 48 years old, and a former Marine. The two members had escaped over the weekend as the rest of the secessionist group gave itself up peacefully. At a sentencing hearing yesterday, an Army drill sergeant, convicted of 18 counts of raping 6 female trainees, apologized for his actions. NPR's Philip Davis reports from the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland.
It wasn't until he faced a sentence of life in prison for rape that Drill Sergeant Delmar Simpson decided to testify in his own behalf. Standing before the military jury that is now to decide his fate, Simpson profusely apologized to his mother, to his wife, to his children, and to the women who say they were his victims. His voice not wavering, he said, "I failed you as a drill sergeant." Simpson confessed that he had become blind to the moral values that he learned in childhood and thus threw away a promising career in the military. As he spoke, his mother and other family members in the small courtroom wept. Though a psychiatrist testified that Simpson had an almost narcissistic personality, Simpson said that if given a chance, he could regain his moral compass. The military jury began its deliberations this morning. At the Aberdeen Proving Ground, I'm Philip Davis.
President Clinton is in Mexico for 2 days of talks. He'll meet today with President Ernesto Zedillo. This is the beginning of a brief tour of Central America and the Caribbean for the president. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 21 points at 7,235. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is extending yesterday's record level with more gains today. But the NASDAQ Composite Index is lower. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports from New York.
The market continues to benefit from the notion of stable interest rates. This morning's report on March factory orders was slightly weaker than expected. However, semiconductor issues are lower after industry leader Intel said it's reviewing the claim of a flaw in its latest microprocessor, the Pentium 2. And tobacco stocks have weakened on word that a proposed settlement with the tobacco industry includes a plan where cigarette makers would pay $375 billion over 15 years for smoking-related illnesses. That's more than expected. This proposal also includes a plan for financial penalties if the rate of youth smoking doesn't decline. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government says orders received by factories in March dropped 1.6%. The Commerce Department reports that's the biggest loss since last year. The drop comes after smaller-than-expected gains in factory orders for February. Much of the March drop was led by declines in manufactured goods. A published report says 10,000 jobs could be lost when Bell Atlantic and NYNEX merge. The Wall Street Journal says that's three times the company's first estimates of job losses. Both firms had said that just 3,000 non-union jobs would be lost due to the merger, which was recently approved by the Justice Department. The Journal reports the big job cuts could indicate that a far bigger consolidation plan is coming than previously estimated. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In Kinshasa, the capital of Zaire, people are waiting nervously to see what will happen next. President Mobutu Sese Seko, the country's dictator, is on his way out. The question is which exit he will leave by. The troops, led by his longtime rival, Laurent Kabila, have already taken over most of the country and are now approaching the capital. Meanwhile, Nelson Mandela has been trying to broker an agreement between Mobutu and Kabila, in which Mobutu, who has advanced prostate cancer, would peacefully relinquish power. Mobutu has ruled the country ever since declaring himself president in 1965. Zaire, formerly known as the Congo, got its independence from Belgium in 1960. Earlier today, we phoned Howard French, who was in Kinshasa covering the civil war for the New York Times. We talked about the war and his experiences covering it. I asked him to describe the atmosphere today in Kinshasa as rebel troops approach the city.
It's a very strange atmosphere. On one level, the city is remarkably calm. People are going about their business as if nothing in particular were happening, that is ordinary people. And then at a whole other level of society, things are very tense. The wealthy here are either packing up and leaving or trying to figure out how to get out or what will happen to them if they don't get out. So you have two different realities here, the reality of the common people who are sort of looking forward to the change that everyone expects to take place here soon, and the reality of the elite, which is very much dreading the unknown that lies ahead.
Why are some people who aren't rich looking forward to the change? I mean, I can understand why they want Mobutu to leave, but what are they looking forward to about Kabila?
People don't really know very much about Kabila, but the one thing that they do know is that Kabila offers the first real chance that most Zaireans have seen in their entire lives to get rid of Mobutu. And Mobutu has been in power here for 32 years nearly and has driven this country into the ground. And Zaireans are very eager for change. Because of that, I have the feeling in talking to people that almost, well, I won't say unanimously, but at a very high percentage of Zaireans are ready to welcome Kabila with open arms, even though Kabila remains, in fact, an unknown quantity.
In other cities, when Kabila's troops have come in, Mobutu's troops have fled. So there really hasn't been that much of direct confrontation. And right now, Nelson Mandela is trying to broker an agreement between Kabila and Mobutu. What do you think the odds are that there's actually going to be fighting in Kinshasa?
That's the big unknown, and that's part of why everybody is on edge here, whether they're for Kabila, as most people seem to be, or for Mobutu. No one knows how the presidential guard here will react to the approach of the rebels. The presidential guard was built up over years by Mobutu, drawn from his own ethnic group, the Mbandi tribe of the north, far north of Zaire, and a bunch of related groups, and they have been treated pretty well by Mobutu, paid, unlike most soldiers, both regularly and with reasonable salaries, and they are armed better than almost any other, well, better than any other Zairean units, and everyone wonders whether, when the rebels approach, these guys will mount a last stand of any kind or not, and if so, how violent it will be, whether how much destruction the capital will see. Sort of associated with that is a fear of just generalized mayhem by soldiers, not just of the presidential guard, but soldiers of all kind, and there are thousands and thousands of them in the city, who, in moments of great tension here, have shown a propensity for looting. Both historically, in the last 10 years, the city's been sort of sacked by soldiers twice, and during this war, every time the rebels get close, before the rebels even engage in combat, the soldiers who happen to be in a city loot it thoroughly before taking off. So you have those two sorts of fears that hang over the city right now, that Mobutu's presidential guard will mount a final stand that will see mortars and all sorts of other heavy artillery brought to bear on the city and reaping widespread destruction, and the other one that there'll just be mayhem here and Kinshasa will be looted and perhaps burned.
Who's in the rebel troops? I've read that most of Kabila's troops are teenage soldiers.
Indeed, that's true. Kabila has had recruitment rallies in cities that he's captured, starting with Goma in the Far East, but, you know, as he's spread across the country, all the way across everywhere, every major city that he's captured, they have mounted recruitment drives. And watching the film footage of the drives and of the parades that the newly uniformed soldiers have engaged in, one can't help but notice that Kabila's troops are by and large kids, say between the age of 14 and 18, with most of them sort of seeming to come from the younger part of that age range. He hasn't really gotten very much heat for that, which is one of the unusual things about this war. I mean, there's been a lot of attention to treatment of refugees, which indeed deserves to be discussed. But the use of child soldiers, which was a prominent feature of the Liberian Civil War over the last several years, has not gotten very much attention here in Zaire.
Are these soldiers and their young teens disciplined?
That's another remarkable element of this war. Kabila's troops, by comparison with Mobutu's troops, are extraordinarily well disciplined. There have been almost no reports of looting by Kabila's troops. There have been instances where isolated cases of theft have been immediately punished and the stolen goods returned to the owners. I remember when the city of Kisangani fell a few weeks back. That's Zaire's third largest city in the north of the country. There was a Belgian, former colonial Belgian farmer who's been there forever and ever, who the rebels arrived at his house and asked him if they could use his car, and he assumed that was the last he would be seeing of his car and gave them the keys, feeling that he had no choice. And 2 or 3 hours later, to his astonishment, the rebels drove up to his house in his car, handed over the keys, and left. So, yes, there has been a remarkable amount of discipline on the part of the rebels, and that's one of the untold stories. How do you pull that off with fresh recruits who are, moreover, tend to be quite young?
In today's New York Times, you wrote a little bit about how Kabila practices this form of verbal intimidation before sending his troops into a city. What kinds of things does he say? What has he been saying lately?
The typical tactic has been to announce several weeks even before his troops arrive at a given location that they're coming, and that sort of sets the temperature rising in in that target city. After that initial announcement, there's a steady sort of drum roll of warnings that yes, we're coming after such and such a person. We'll be there on such and such a date. Our troops have advanced 50 miles. We're now at the outskirts of this or that town. Give us 2 more days. You better get out. And that's exactly what's happening here with Kinshasa. Kabila told Mobutu yesterday during a press conference he gave in the southern city of Lubumbashi that he would give him 2 or 3 days to decide to surrender power. If he decided to do so, Mobutu and, as Kabila put it, his biological family would be spared. If not, his troops would be in the suburbs of Kinshasa within 2 or 3 days, as of yesterday. and would begin to chase Mobutu out of power in a humiliating fashion, he said. That has been the talk of this city today. No one knows, in fact, exactly how long it's going to take Kabila to get here. There are those who believe that 2 or 3 days is realistic, and there are those who don't. But the fact is that the people who have reason to fear his arrival are very much on edge now. And the ultimate result of that tactic has been that most of the targeted people end up fleeing before the deadline. So Kabila captures a city or takes a strategic prize at minimal cost. The enemy's gone by the time he gets there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Howard French. He's in Kinshasa now reporting on the civil war in Zaire for the New York Times. How is news getting conveyed in Kinshasa now? I mean, obviously, you're reporting on the news for the Times, but I doubt that most of the people in Kinshasa are reading the New York Times. Most of the phone lines aren't functioning. How are people finding out what's actually happening?
Here, as in everywhere in Africa, radio is the biggest source of news for people. And you drive through popular neighborhoods here and you hear radio stations, both Zairean stations and foreign stations. BBC broadcasts in French, Radio France, The Voice of America, as well as several Zairean stations. Radios are on all the time, all over the place, and everyone wants to know what the latest news is. So that's probably the main and most immediate source of news for Zaireans. The other thing that should be said, though, is that Zaire has a very vibrant written press. There are scores of newspapers here. One wonders how they managed to stay afloat. But there are many, many titles, and Zaireans have a rather unique way of reading them. The newspaper vendors set themselves up on street corners, and they pin up the day's front pages on a sort of bulletin board, or sometimes, in fact, just lie them out on the sidewalk, and this draws, on days where there's a lot of news, huge crowds. People come, and they read the titles, and big debates ensue in a very lively fashion. People comment the news as they're reading it and exchange views about the latest development, and this phenomenon has taken on a rather colorful title here. The people who read the newspapers that way and typically don't buy them, they stand there and read them and you know, exchange gossip and analysis. Those people are called les parlementaires debout in French, which means the standing parliament.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Howard French, and he's in Kinshasa reporting on the civil war in Zaire for the New York Times. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Howard French of the New York Times. He's speaking to us by phone from Kinshasa, where he's reporting on Zaire's civil war for the New York Times. Kabila has been Mobutu's rival since the 1960s. Kabila is left over from the Marxist era. Aren't like Mobutu and Kabila kind of dinosaurs by now? I mean, aren't there any young strongmen around who can be vying with them for power?
The problem is that Mobutu has not allowed rivals to, for most of his time in power, did not allow rivals to emerge. He would kill them off, force them into exile, or corrupt them. So that prevented the emergence, really, of a viable class of younger politicians who might have something better to offer to their country. Kabila, unlike the other revolutionaries here in Zaire of his generation, was never bought off, was never really permanently exiled, and obviously wasn't killed. He stayed in the bush in the far east of the country in a mountain range called the Fizi Baraka Mountains. and pretty much mined gold there, sold ivory, it is said, and kept a small band of rebels going throughout all of these years. He is very much a figure from the early days of this country's independence from Belgium in 1960. But by virtue of his survival and by virtue of Mobutu's system, which prevented people here in the capital or elsewhere in the country from challenging the dictator's power, he is the only alternative out there for the moment.
What is at stake for the rest of Africa and for the United States now in Zaire?
What's at stake for the rest of Africa is the stability of a huge part of the continent. If Zaire cannot be governed in a stable fashion, then that has tremendous consequences for a very large portion of this continent. Zaire borders on 9 other countries. Several of them are in great difficulty right now politically themselves. Trouble in Zaire will mean that it's that much more difficult for them to get their houses in order. Economically speaking, the fact that you have this huge and very richly endowed country of 45 million people sort of taken off of the world's economic circuit because of the misgovernment by Mobutu, the collapse of the economy here, the failure of the leadership here to try to do anything serious in terms of getting the country back running in an honest and productive fashion is very costly economically to the rest of the continent. Neighbor states could trade with a functioning Zaire in a very lucrative way. Now they can't. All that exists is the black market and small informal trade. For the United States, the reasons just mentioned are very important. There is also a sense, I think, that Zaire has had its hand in a lot of conflicts throughout this continent for many years, some of them at the United States' behest, notably in Angola during the Cold War. Mobutu was helping the anti-communist UNITA rebel movement with massive CIA assistance. Washington no longer wants to wage that battle, but Mobutu has continued to help UNITA to the detriment of a peace arrangement between the former rebels in Angola and the government. Zaire has had its hand in conflicts in Sudan, in Uganda, in Rwanda, in Burundi, and in Chad, in addition to its hand in the conflict in Angola. So the idea is that if Zaire were given a stable, reasonably honest, and ordinary government by African standards, then for Washington, one of the interests is that a lot of trouble cutting from the northeast of Africa all the way to the southwest of Africa would begin to die down, and you would have an end to humanitarian crises. You would have much calmer political situations in those countries, and eventually, potentially, Zaire would come to would become a big economic player that could interest, as it did a long time ago, major investment from the United States and elsewhere in the West.
I think one of the paradoxes of Mobutu's rule is that he's kind of cloaked himself in the rhetoric of African nationalism and cultural identity. He called his political movement authenticity. And yet he's destroyed his own country. He's destroyed a large part of Africa. Can you talk a little bit about that contradiction during his reign?
The principal lesson to draw from that, I think, is that it's easier to defend a notion of nationalism with rhetoric than it is to build a viable country. Mobutu very effectively constructed a whole vision of ideology of his country as a sort of torchlight for the rest of Africa to follow, and was indeed followed for many years by a number of other African dictators. Authenticity was, for a time, and even continues to be for many Zaireans, something that is seen as being positive, that why should Zaireans in a blanket fashion adopt Western names when Zaireans from time immemorial have had their own names? Why should Zaireans mimic Western dress when, in fact, Africans have always had their own dress, et cetera, et cetera? Mobutu was very clever in identifying ideas like that that would appeal to the pride of Africans in themselves. And it both reinforced his rule to do so, and by doing so, he managed, and he hasn't gotten perhaps enough credit for this, to forge an identity of for his people of all belonging to one nation, which he decided, as I said, to call Zaire. So, yes, Mobutu has destroyed his economy, but the paradox is, as you said a moment ago, he has managed at the same time to forge a sense of nation that, even as his rule goes down the drain, remains viable.
I guess in some ways that was a difficult thing to do, because there's, what, about 200 or 250 different ethnic groups in Zaire. So imagine holding them together in nationhood is not that easy.
There's so many ethnic groups here that I don't think anybody really has a good number for them. But 250 is one of the numbers one sees often. To give you an idea of what Mobutu did, Zaire today is a country in which people speak, educated people, and people for the most part, in fact, speak French. But they also have two main lingua franca in the country. In the western half of the country, almost everyone speaks a language called Lingala. In the eastern half of the country, almost everyone speaks Swahili, regardless of what their tribal language is, the language of their mother tongue, the language they speak at home. Nearly everyone speaks one of those two languages. African countries that don't have common languages tend often to be countries where tribalism is particularly troublesome. And Mobutu had the foresight to figure out that an important element of sort of welding people together was encouraging the emergence of a couple of languages that virtually everyone could speak. And Zaire was too big for him to choose one, and so he promoted these two languages.
Howard French is in Kinshasa, the capital of Zaire, covering the country for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Zaire's longtime dictator rose to power in the 1960s with the help of the CIA. We continue our conversation with New York Times reporter Howard French. He'll also tell us about some of his adventures covering Zaire. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Howard French, who is in Kinshasa, the capital of Zaire, covering the civil war for the New York Times. We phoned him in Kinshasa earlier today to talk about the war and his experiences covering it. The longtime dictator of the country, Mobutu Sese Seko, is under pressure from the international community to give up power, and he's also facing rebel troops led by his longtime rival, Laurent Kabila, which are approaching the capital. Mobutu is credited with leading his country into economic ruin. Zaire has become a very poor country. Mobutu, I think, has something like $6 billion, and his palace has been called Versailles in the jungle. Where did he get his money from?
Mobutu got his money from virtually every way one could make money in Zaire, from taking a cut on every sizable government contract or deal that was made during his rule. In the 1970s, when there were big expropriations of foreign-owned property here under a program that followed authenticity that was called Africanization or Zaireanization, Mobutu distributed properties, plantations, factories, businesses to his cronies, but took many of the biggest ones for himself. There was a plantation called the Selva Plantation that was an agricultural and livestock company that had huge land holdings. And Mobutu, overnight through this Zaireanization, inherited more land than the size of the country of Rwanda. He inherited 25,000 employees overnight from just this one nationalization. Not today because the rebels have taken this over, but until very recently, Mobutu had a hand in every diamond deal done in Zaire. There's a large diamond company, state-owned company called Miba in the central city of Mbuji-Mayi that was selling, maybe $20 million of diamonds every month, being exported straight to Antwerp. Well, Mobutu, it is thought, had a cut of, say, between 15 and 20% of that every month, year after year after year. The same was true for copper and cobalt in the country's south. The same is true for import licenses. Mobutu has had a hand in everything here that's been worth having a hand in business-wise, and the people raise questions about whether he really does still have $5 or $6 billion, or whether indeed he ever had that much. But it is beyond question that the man has had huge amounts of income for a very long time.
You know, another obvious paradox about Mobutu's rule is that although he's used the language of African nationalism and has done some genuinely, African nationalistic things during his regime, he's really been supported by the West. I think wouldn't have never maintained power early on if it wasn't for the CIA propping him up.
That's certainly true. Mobutu was pushed sort of to the front of the stage by the CIA, which encouraged him to knock off the first prime minister of the country, Lumumba, and to seize power temporarily in 1961. In 1965, the CIA again encouraged him to take power, and he did so in a permanent fashion. Mobutu's nationalism has been a direct domestic nationalism in terms of appealing to African pride and the idea of Zaire as a huge and strong or would-be strong nation that would have sort of an image abroad corresponding to its gigantic size. Mobutu has always been reviled in so-called progressive circles in Africa, in countries like Tanzania and Zimbabwe and Nkrumah's Ghana earlier on, because in fact he was seen as the lackey of the West. In terms of foreign policy, the only way he's ever tried to undo that image is by maintaining ties with the Chinese, which he has done for quite some time. With Libya, he entertained quite close ties for a while. With North Korea, these were sort of meant to confuse the picture of him as being the sort of handmaiden of the West. But in fact, within African circles, Mobutu has always been seen as the creation of Washington and a man kept in power by Western intervention.
Listen, forgive me if this sounds culturally insensitive, but every time I see a picture of Mobutu, I hear Bob Dylan's recording of leopard skin pillbox hat. Is the leopard skin hat that he wears meant to be a sign of his Africanism?
It's probably more a sign of his ego than Africanism. I mean, leopard skin hats are not something that one sees Africans wearing generally. They were sort of in fashion when Mobutu first began wearing them. Other Zaireans began wearing them. But there's nothing particularly African about wearing a leopard skin cap. The story goes back to Mobutu's personal mythology, that he told a story early on about how he was once fearful and as a boy in the northern countryside where he grew up, and his father or uncle took him out to hunt as a way to conquer his fear, and made him kill a leopard, and Mobutu indeed lived up to the task and thrust his spear into the leopard, and the leopard died, and Mobutu then therefore appropriated the symbol of the leopard, and as the story goes, has never been afraid again. The other story that is part of his myth that goes to sort of animal symbolism is the eagle. Mobutu carries a massive wooden carved cane that has a handsome eagle at its crest or at the handle of the cane. And Mobutu is said to identify with the eagle because he soars above the scene, unlike ordinary mortals, and has extraordinary eyesight and can see things coming and is always above the fray. So those were the two images of himself that he sought to promote. They really have to do more with the outsized ego of this man than with any real notion of authentic Africanness.
Joining us on the phone from Kinshasa, the capital of Zaire, is Howard French of the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Howard French, who's covering the war in Zaire for the New York Times. Do Kabila's troops or Mobutu's troops respect the press? Or do you feel like you are endangered when you run into troops?
Kabila's troops are still an open question. I think that they are fairly disciplined, so that I don't recall any stories of reporters having been actually assaulted by them. There's a growing question of tolerance of the press in Kabila's areas and freedom of the press, and whether or not Zairean and foreign journalists will be allowed to move about freely and to cover things as they see fit and to question the behavior of Kabila's movement and what one expects will soon be Kabila's government. In Mobutu's part of the country, the government really it tolerates the press in an official sense, but then goes out of its way to harass them. I've been arrested several times here in Zaire, even though my papers are all in order. There's almost a sort of a hunt for foreign journalists by the secret police here, who believe that we are sort of cash cows. That if they pick up on the streets, they can milk for $50 or $100. And a lot of us have been picked up like that. The soldiers, there was an opposition march against the government here a few weeks ago, and the soldiers who were trying to prevent the march really let loose against the journalists here. My photographer was knocked to the ground by a truck, army truck door opening on him deliberately, and then a soldier ripped one of his cameras away from him. A number of TV crews and other photographers and even reporters had gear stolen from them, and we were all heavily tear-gassed when the demonstration reached the Prime Minister's office here, which was the final gathering point. So there's nothing sacred about being a foreign correspondent here. They don't make no bones about stealing your stuff or indeed attacking you.
When you've been arrested, have you delivered with money to the people who are obviously looking for money?
I believe very strongly in not bribing people, and I have a long experience in out being more patient than my arresters. Sometimes you can't afford. I mean, sometimes the circumstances are such that you sort of have to give in. But I have been pretty successful not surrendering money. I've heard horrible tales of colleagues of mine, being held up for as much as $500 or more, even at the airport before they've gotten into town here. And I'm happy to say that I've never given in like that. I have more. What's worse to me, though, is that I was in, for example, Lubumbashi, which is the southern copper mining capital, a couple of months ago before the city fell to the rebels. And I was making my rounds. I'd gone to the university to talk to students and, was touring a mining neighborhood near a copper smelter. And the secret police arrested us, myself and my photographer, they hauled us in, kept us for most of the night in their headquarters, and the end result, we didn't have to give up any money, but the end result was that all of my notebooks from that trip were seized, as was my photographer's film, and that is even more painful than having to surrender money, and there was nothing I could do about it, so it was, in a personal sense, in a professional sense, a pretty big loss.
How good is your memory to reconstitute the notes?
Well, I was disappointed because, just beyond the blow of having things stolen from me, it was my first trip to Lubumbashi. I had gone there with great sort of anticipation. It's a great city. It's a totally different place from Kinshasa. The climate's different. The look is different. Architecture, the people, it's just a whole different feel. And the arrest came the night before I was supposed to leave, and I had just finished telling my photographer, whose name I should mention, Robert Grossman, what a great visit this had been and how excited I was about writing the story. And then, within an hour, we were hauled in and our stuff was taken from us. I wrote a story. It was a very disappointing experience because even if you can repeat, you can recapture scene and things like that, you can never recapture. I do dozens of interviews in a day, and you just can't recapture that. I can't quote people just from memory the next day after having interviewed so many people. And the other thing was I felt that I might have jeopardized the safety of some of the people who talked to me because their names and quotes were in my notebooks, and the secret police sees this stuff, and who knows what was going to become of those people afterward.
Do you know if anything happened to them as a result of the notes?
I don't know. I've not been able to find out. It's one of these things. It's just a terrible thing. I can't know. I probably will never know. I've been back to Lubumbashi. I was there last week. But I was there just overnight in this diplomatic delegation, and I was sort of chained to their agenda and had no way of breaking away and trying to find out anything else, including what happened to the people that I interviewed. The good thing is I was told by, I ran into the driver I used in Lubumbashi, and he was all right, and he told me that generally people were very happy in that city, that the secret police had all fled, that all of the soldiers that used to harass people had disappeared, and that there was a sense that people could breathe and talk and enjoy some sense of liberty again. So hopefully the people who confided in me in those interviews are enjoying that themselves now.
You sound pretty calm and focused, but you're waiting for rebel troops to move into Kinshasa, and you don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know how you're going to cover what happens next. You don't know if mayhem's going to take over the city or what. Do you really feel calm and focused, or are you a little edgy right now?
I have something of a certain sense of, I don't want to, fatalism is probably not the best word for it, but you have to, I think, in this job, you just can't afford to get rattled by things, especially things that you don't know or, you know, can't anticipate. You try to be as smart as you can. You try not to take imprudent risks. Then you get on with your work. There's no way to know, as you said, what's going to happen here, but my job is to write about it, so I sort of have to be here when whatever happens, happens. And I made the adjustment to that sort of thing a long time ago. You know, when bullets start flying, if they do, or the city is on fire and there's mayhem here, it's frightening, and people in my job, like ordinary Zairians, will be frightened. But there's no sense in getting panicked about it right now. You just have to sort of carry on doing what you're doing and stay focused. I mean, there's really no alternative. It's sort of like air travel in Africa. I get on airplanes all the time, and I don't think about it because I have to get on airplanes, and that's the only way to get around. But African air travel is, by the standards of the United States or of the West generally, is horribly dangerous. You just have to, I mean, there's some things you just have to do, and you have to accept that's part of what your life is made of. So, hope for the best and get on with it.
What's the worst situation you've been caught in so far in Zaire?
In Zaire, the worst thing I've been caught in, I mean, there's a few ways of answering that. I mean, probably the most traumatic thing that I've done in Zaire has not had anything to do with any danger or risk to myself. I was in the city of Ubundu, which is near Kisangani in the northeast, a few weeks ago, covering the Hutu refugees there, and I came away really shaken by what I saw. I mean, these people who have been tracked clear across Zaire, hundreds of miles, wherever they gather, as soon as the international community begins to sort of bring relief to them, they are set upon again by the rebels and by local villagers sometimes. It was just, it was a traumatic experience to see this. I mean, having little kids, I had seen the same population in a few places and sort of followed their progression westward, trying to stay ahead of the rebels and stay out of, to avoid being hunted down by the rebels. And just going to this very desperate place where they had reached the banks of the Zaire River, and there was no way for them to get, no easy way for them to get across. And the fear that the rebels were just a few steps behind them and would be attacking at any minute and or any day, and no relief in sight. And the people were just extraordinarily dispirited and very weak, and lots of children who hadn't seen their parents for weeks. Presumably, their parents were dead. And having kids sort of cling to you, and they couldn't even speak a language that I can speak. But it was disturbing to be powerless to help people, even though. As the story has it, a lot of these people were associated with the violence in Rwanda a couple of years ago that led to the killing of a lot of Tutsis. I mean, when you see women and children, for the most part, and that's what the bulk of this population was, subjected to that sort of horrifying experience, it's worse than anything that I've had to experience myself, and I don't. You know, it's not even appropriate to think about what little risk or trauma that's been directed at me. I mean, it was sickening, really, to watch it.
Howard French, what story are you working on right now for the New York Times?
The word today here in Kinshasa is that Mobutu is sort of trying to engineer an exit from the country that would allow him to avoid handing over directly to Kabila and avoid resigning, leaving with pretending still to be president. What people are saying, and indeed there's confirmation from some of the president's assistants, is that tomorrow Mobutu will be leaving Zaire for a meeting to be held in the Central African country of Gabon, which is not too far from here, for a meeting with a bunch of other French-speaking African leaders on the Great Lakes crisis, the crisis affecting his country and Rwanda and Burundi. It's pretty generally believed here that if, in fact, he leaves the country tomorrow, there's not much chance that he'll come back. Kabila's people have said that they'll be here within 2 or 3 days. They said that yesterday. And I sort of expect that if Mobutu leaves, then pretty shortly afterwards, the rebels will be here, they'll seize the airport, and the question of the Mobutu era will be over.
Well, Howard French, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of a very busy day for you in Kinshasa to talk with us, and I wish you good luck over the next few days.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Howard French is in Kinshasa covering the war in Zaire for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. Coming up, a new novel dealing with rape and abortion by Irish writer Edna O'Brien. This is Fresh Air. Edna O'Brien's early novels were banned in her native Ireland for their depiction of female sexuality. Her new novel, Down by the River, is likely to cause a stir as well. It's inspired by a controversial abortion decision handed down in Ireland a few years ago. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Edna O'Brien's literary take on Ireland has nothing in common with William Butler Yeats's visionary nationalism, the mystical erotics of U2's music, or the Celtic kitsch of Michael Flatley's Lord of the Dance. No, O'Brien's writing is in the rougher James Joyce, Sean O'Casey tradition that paints Ireland as a crabbed, priest-ridden country where sexual brutality festers in a damp climate of silence. Like her infamous predecessors, O'Brien is an expatriate. She's lived for decades in London. It's safe to say that distance has not made her heart grow fonder. In her latest novel, Down by the River, O'Brien casts a cold eye on family and village life in Ireland, as well as on the country's draconian anti-abortion laws. No gentle rains nor gentle kisses soften the harsh realities of her characters' lives. Particularly when it comes to depicting the situation of women in Ireland, Edna O'Brien truly is Maeve Binchy's evil twin. The miserable heroine of this story is 14-year-old Mary McNamara, who lives with her parents in the countryside. Mary's father, James, fits the typical failed Irish father mold. He has a weakness for drink and for dreamy get-rich-quick schemes. When we first meet him, he and Mary are digging up bogs in hopes of finding prehistoric treasure. But James's loser charm is short-lived, for on this same outing, he pushes Mary down in the muck and rapes her. Isolated and shamed, Mary can talk to no one about the horror she only halfway comprehends. She thinks of her violated self in terms of a birthday cake she once saw at a party, lovely and seemingly uncut. But, she recalls, when she brought her face up close to it, she saw every piece had been severed, every severed piece side by side, a wicked decoy. For the past few years, we've been so inundated with novels and autobiographies about father-daughter incest that, as simultaneously gut-wrenching and incandescent as O'Brien's account is, it's hard as a reader not to feel jaded. But after the first 50 pages of Down by the River, the plot shoots off into an even more appalling direction. Mary learns she's pregnant at the same time that her mother, invaded by fast-multiplying cells of a different kind, dies of ovarian cancer. Terrified, Mary turns to a neighbor woman for help, and this neighbor, with many misgivings, secretly takes her to England for an abortion. On the night before the abortion is scheduled, however, right-to-life zealots discover Mary's plans. They alert the law, and she's made to return to Ireland, where she becomes the focus of a Supreme Court case to decide whether or not an underage incest victim should be forced to carry a pregnancy to term. Like her native land, Mary's body is now contested terrain. "Rosaries and ovaries," says Mary's doctor. "I don't know which does the most damage to this country." He's one of the many adult hand-wringers surrounding Mary, whose glib way with words camouflages his moral paralysis. O'Brien's scorn for Mary's supposed protectors and critics is well matched by the energy she devotes to developing the character of Mary herself. Mary, of course, is in a unique situation, but the portrait O'Brien paints of a shy, eager-to-please girl who feels afraid of her own body and powerless in the company of adults will bring many readers wincingly back to their own adolescence. Down by the River was inspired by an actual abortion case in Ireland a few years ago, but O'Brien's furious imagination transforms the real-life details into something rich and strange and suspenseful. As tortured as her relationship is to Ireland, O'Brien proves once again that she has the native daughter's gift for making poetry out of politics.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Down by the River by Edna O'Brien. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scherer. I'm Tariq Rose.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.